Well, our text for this morning's lesson is going to be from Matthew chapter 13, like Austin already read earlier in our worship. But before we get to Matthew 13, let's open up to Psalm 73 by way of introduction. Notice just the first few verses of Psalm 73 and the predicament that the writer finds himself in. He says that surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. That makes sense. Surely God is good to those who are pure in heart. Surely God looks at the good people of the world and treats them accordingly, and looks at bad people of the world and treats them accordingly. But as for me, he says in verse 2, my feet came close to stumbling. My steps had almost slipped. He says there was something that didn't quite mesh in life. My preconceived idea about how God should treat good people and how God should treat bad people nearly caused me to slip when I compared the preconception with reality. The two things didn't match up. He goes on to say in verse 3, I was envious of the arrogant as I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no pains in their death, their body is fat, they're not in trouble as other men, nor are they plagued like mankind. Pride, he says, is their necklace. The garment of violence covers them. Their eye bulges from fatness. The imaginations of their heart run riot. They mock and wickedly speak of oppression. They speak from on high. They've set their mouth against the heavens, and their tongue parades through the earth. Now, what the writer of Psalm 73 is observing is no different than what a lot of us find ourselves asking. Why is it that we can look at the world as it is and see a lot of bad people getting away with their bad deeds? Bad people who seem to live just as well or better than the good people of the world. Why doesn't God do something about it? Why does He just allow drug kingpins to get away with it? Why does He just allow pedophiles and child molesters to go unpunished? Why does He allow dictators to run countries into the ground? Why does God just sit by idly while the wicked people of the world do whatever they want with impunity? Matthew 13 gives us an answer to that. Let's go to Matthew 13 now, and let's notice the parable once again here that Jesus offers in Matthew 13, beginning in verse 24. The kingdom of heaven, Jesus says, may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed tares also among the wheat, and he went away. But when the wheat sprang up and bore grain, then the tares became evident also. And the slaves of the landowner came and said to him, Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares? And he said to them, An enemy has done this. And the slave said to him, Do you want us then to gather them up? But he said, No, lest while you are gathering up the tares, you may root up the wheat with them. Allow both of them to grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, First gather up the tares, bind them up in bundles, and burn them. But gather the wheat into my barn. Now Jesus goes on to offer an explanation here later on, beginning in verse 37, as to this parable. The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man, and the field is the world, and as for the good seed, these are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the sons of the evil one. Verse 39, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Therefore, he says in verse 40, just as the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send forth His angels, and they will gather out of His kingdom all stumbling blocks, and those who commit lawlessness will cast them into the furnace of fire. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then He says in verse 43, that the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear. A couple of observations here as we begin our study of this particular text. First of all, I like that the Son of Man is the one who sows the good seed. That God does not allow this to go to just anybody, This isn't just anybody's responsibility. This isn't just any kind of minimum wage worker up in heaven who gets to sow the seed. This is the Son of Man who's in charge of this. It's the Son of Man given this awesome responsibility of planting righteous people where they ought to be in this world. Interesting thought then. Jesus himself says very clearly that the good seed is sown by the Son of Man. The field is the world. And the good seed, these are the sons of the kingdom. God plants you where you're most effective. But God doesn't necessarily plant you where you want to be. I think it's an interesting thought there, isn't it? It's not up to the seed which field it gets thrown into in this parable. Of course, let's not mix up parables, okay? Focus on the seed in this particular parable, not in other parables about seeds. It's not up to the seed which field it gets put into. The Son of Man gathers up a handful of seeds and he puts them where he wants them to be. He wants those seeds in the midst of the world. He wants those seeds where they can be useful, where they can make a difference in other people's lives. And we forget about that sometimes. Don't you think it would just be easier, we sometimes argue, wouldn't it just be easier if we could just build like a commune out in the wilderness and we could all just grow our own vegetables and Jason can be in charge of the cattle? Wouldn't it be just great if we could just all be Christians together and not have any bad people around, not have to deal with all the stuff that happens in the world? Yeah, maybe it would be easier. I'm not so sure it would actually be easier. Maybe perception doesn't match with reality in that regard also. But I'll tell you one thing. Whether it's easier or not, having a bunch of Christians in a commune in the wilderness, I'll tell you one thing. It's not more effective. It's not very useful. God doesn't want us living in a commune in the wilderness. He wants us in the world. That's where he's planted us. And don't forget that. Those who are evil are the unbelieving ones. They're the tares. They're the weeds. They're noxious. You notice that in the same way that the Son of Man plants his seed where he wants them, the son of the devil also is where the devil wants him. Satan is going to plant his seeds where he wants them as well. And I think that's interesting to observe too. You almost have like a chess match going on between God and Satan. Of course, we all know how the story ends. We're studying Revelation. We know how the chess match ends. It's kind of like when you match yourself up with a computer, all right, and you set it to like hard, you know, like hard difficulty level, and you say like, oh, let's go. And in like 3 moves, the computer beats you. Like, okay, well, this was decided well in advance. But you, like I said, you almost have like a chess match going on here where the Son of Man is going to put his seed where he wants them, and the devil's going to put his seed where he wants them. The sons of the devil are strategically placed so that they can trip up as many of the sons of God as possible. And all of the elements in this story are allowed by God to coexist until the harvest, which Jesus explains is the end of the world. The storyline of this parable, as one writer puts it in The Message of Heaven and Hell by Bruce Milne, the storyline of this parable would have resonated in that agrarian culture. Weeds were as great a threat then as today, and every bit as prevalent. The particular weed here is probably what is often known as darnel, a poisonous weed closely, it's sometimes called poison darnel also is another name for it. It's a poisonous weed closely related to breaded wheat. And in the early stages of growth, it's very hard to distinguish from it. It was a common practice to weed out the darnel as it appeared, but in the parable's case, the weeds have made significant headway. The roots of the darnel have become so entangled that an attempt at weeding would threaten the crop itself. The surprise of the servants is at the extent of the infestation of the weeds in their master's crop. I looked up darnel, by the way, and really, I'm no expert, so really, this doesn't mean anything. You could probably pluck 2 completely different plants in front of me, and I really wouldn't have any idea. Trust me, don't let me out in the wilderness without food that I brought with me. I would be dead in a week. I guarantee it. But when you compare the darnel to the wheat, they are strikingly similar-looking plants. And the Bible, by the way, is not the only piece of ancient literature that compares the wheat and the darnel, the wheat and the tares. There's a lot of other pieces of literature, historically speaking, that will take that imagery and use it the same way that Jesus has. We're left with many questions then. Why does God allow evil people to exist amongst good people, seemingly unmolested? Why does the landowner in the parable allow the weeds and the wheat to coexist, again, without any interference until the very end? We face a lot of similar questions today. Why does God allow evil to abound in this world? How can a supposedly all-powerful God observe so many people resisting His will? Why do so few turn to the gospel if it has the power of salvation? And I think that this parable helps us cope with all of those questions. You want to know the answers? Jesus gives you the answer here. First of all, remember that it's never God's intention for evil to exist in this world. In this parable, the landowner did not want the tares. He's not the one who put the weeds there. He's not the one who placed them. Actually, if anything else, he did everything he could to make sure the wheat could grow properly. He had a good piece of land. He had his servants go out at what I would assume would be the proper time of year, since the wheat appeared to grow quite healthily. He took care of the wheat. He thought of the wheat. The wheat was always on his mind, even as he was strategizing on how he was going to deal with the weeds. The wheat was still his main concern. It was never God's intention for the world to look the way it does now. You ever think about that? Why, there's so many evil people in the world. Well, it's not like God planned it that way. It's not like when God created the world, he said, well, and let's just go ahead and assume that they're going to mess this whole thing up. Let's just assume that they're going to invent the atomic bomb, okay? Let's just assume that they're going to use chemical warfare. Let's just assume they're going to rape and pillage and steal from each other. Let's just assume that from the outset. No, God created the world good with the assumption that humanity had the ability to choose right over evil. That was his original assumption, that we had the potential to choose good. Or else why would he have ever given Adam and Eve the choice in the first place? If he didn't believe they could choose the right thing, he never would have plunked a tree in the middle of the Garden of Eden and said, now, don't you eat from that tree. If he didn't think they could choose the right thing, he wouldn't have given them a choice. It was never God's intention for the world to look the way it does now. And what we see in the world is a deviation, a corruption of God's original design, a falling short, if you will, like Romans 3 verse 23 says. God may have many reasons why he allows the weeds to grow up with the wheat. It could be out of concern for the saved, or it could be out of concern for the unrepentant. Either way, consider a couple practical applications. He never wants the believer to be harmed, indirectly or otherwise, by the removal of the unbeliever. When he's talking about the weeds and the wheat, what he really cares about is not the existence of the weeds. He can deal with the weeds. In his arsenal of tools, the landowner can deal with the weeds. I like this interesting point from the parable. The landowner's not panicking. He's not going around, what are we going to do now? He knows exactly what to do. And his servants know what to do. They ask him, should we follow protocol right now? Should we get rid of the weeds? God is in complete control of this world. Just because bad people exist doesn't mean he's up in heaven panicking going, oh no, there's an evil dictator in charge of North Korea. What am I going to do about it? No. The landowner already had protocol in place for dealing with the weeds. It's just that he's not impetuous. He's patient. And his main concern is not what to do about the weeds, but how can we take care of the wheat? We need to change our perspective on some things then. For as bad as it is that we must live around evil people in this world, try to remember that evil people also have to live around us. I think we always kind of have like a woe is me mentality. When, oh, it's such a bad world. So many bad people, bad influences for our kids. You got dirty language at work. I'm surrounded by all kinds of bad people and dirty stuff on TV and filth in the media and We are like so upset because we're surrounded by junk and garbage in this world. Well, we forget then. If you kind of flip that on its head and realize, no, it's not that I have to live around the world. It's that the world has to live around me. They're the ones who have to put up with my Christianity. Then you go on the offensive as a believer in God. You go on the offensive. You're not always hiding from opportunities to serve. You're jumping at opportunities to serve and be a witness for God. No, I am going to make the rest of the world so uncomfortable because of my faith that it will cause a cleaver. They will either have to choose Christianity with me, or they will have to choose the ways of the world and live with its consequences. I think that's a really good way to approach it, isn't it? Don't be scared of the world. Make the world scared of you. Always have a Bible answer for things. Always have the moral choice ready to go. Wear your Christianity on your sleeve. Let people know that they're not allowed to talk dirty around you. Let people know that there are certain ways that they are not allowed to treat your family, your children, your spouse. Let them know that certain TV shows go off when you enter the break room at work. The radio station changes. Or you make a big hissy fit about it and go eat your lunch in the parking lot. Make the world uncomfortable. They have to live around you. It's not the other way around. As long as the tares are around, we have an opportunity to change them. And I'm grateful to God for that. I'm grateful that God didn't just pull the trigger. That the landowner in this story didn't just say, we got some tares in the field, rip them out. No. As long as I get to be around those weeds, I get a chance to change them. I get a chance to be a good influence on them. I get a chance to teach them the gospel and make them from noxious, poisonous weeds to productive, useful wheat. And if God rips the bad people out of the world, if God does just let us live in a commune by ourselves out in the wilderness, we never have a chance to change people like that. We never have a chance to help people find the real potential within them for good and mercy and compassion and to accept forgiveness as God offers it so, so beautifully. I'm reminded of 1 Corinthians 5, verses 9 and 10. This very passage addresses this idea here. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 and 10, he says, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. Now, I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or the swindlers, or with the idolaters, for then you would have to go out of this world. I've always liked the way Paul puts that. You can't avoid the association with the world. It's there. Instead of trying to run away from it, run into it headlong and show them just what you're made of spiritually. There is another sower in this story, isn't there? When we look at bad people in the world, we always want to blame the first sower. We want to blame the landowner. We want to blame God. We say, why does God allow bad people to exist? Why doesn't God do something about evil people? How come God put this evil person in my life? Why did God put a stumbling block before me? A tempter for my children. We forget it wasn't God who did that. Don't blame God because of the existence of bad people. No, there's another sower in this story. The insidious one. The troublemaking one. The meddler. Or as the landowner calls him, my enemy who has done this. Evil exists in this world not because of God but because of someone else. And that was true right from the beginning. It was God, it was Adam and Eve, and was there another character in the story somewhere in Genesis 3? Yeah. Don't forget, when you're looking for someone to blame about the existence of bad things in this world, don't forget that there was another character in Genesis 3 who makes his appearance there. It was the tempter.
Let's remember a couple things here. God is not the cause of the evil that exists in the world. Satan is. Satan is the enemy of both God and mankind. Satan is underhanded. He doesn't play by the rules. He sneaks around at night. He doesn't do things out in the open. He doesn't do things in the daytime. You know why? Because he's scared of God. He's scared of God. I like this image of Satan in this story, symbolically portrayed as the enemy. I like this image of the enemy having to snoop around at night because he's scared of what the landowner has in store for him. He's scared of the potential that the landowner has for punishment, for justice and judgment. He's snooping around at night because he knows he can't get away with it during the daytime. But Satan is also very aggressive in his tactics. He's aggressive in his messages. He's aggressive and very vocal. He wants you to know that there's another option out there. He wants you to know that it is open recruitment on the weed team. Anyone who wants to join the weeds, I have open recruitment. And he's very vocal about it. A couple passages for you to think about. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 1 was like that one. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, and let's notice here, 1 Timothy 4 and verse 1. But the Spirit says that in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. That's Satan's recruiting tactics right there. They'll listen to the recruiter. The doctrines of demons, the deceitful spirits, they'll listen to the recruiter. They'll pick up the message. Peter also said something in one of his epistles. In 2 Peter, let's see here, 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 1. But false prophets also arose among the people, just as there will also be false teachers among you, who will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves. And many will follow after their sensuality, and because of them the way of the truth will be maligned. And in their greed they will exploit you with false words. Their judgment from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. I think Peter remembered that parable that Jesus said. I think Peter had the wheat and the tares in mind when he was saying that. In 2 Peter chapter 2, Satan is recruiting an army. But he knows he's lost the war already. And that judgment, deemed from long ago to be just and right, it will be swift. It will be swift. Only two options exist in this story then. I'm either wheat or I'm a weed. There's only two teams in this game. There's only two armies in this battle. Nobody gets to stand on the sidelines. Nobody gets to ride the fence. You're either wheat or you're a weed. Interesting the way that the growth of these two things happens together. The wheat and the weeds are planted at the same time. They grow up at the same time. They grow at about the same rate, to about the same height. Darnell gets to be about a meter tall at its tallest. One writer put it really well, the same book that I quoted earlier. Growing together in its way summarizes the whole human story from the dawn of civilization to the present. The good and the bad, the servants of God and the servants of Satan, the men and women of ideals and values, and the men and women who have despised these things, those who have aspired to the skies and those who have sunk to the depths, and all the multitudes who have found themselves somewhere between moving along on the highways of history, born, surviving, developing, maturing, aging, dying, growing together in the great bundle of human life on planet Earth. And so it will go on through the course of this century, this millennium, and on for as long as history exists, seemingly endlessly on until harvest time. We're no different than the writer of Psalm 73. Remember how we quoted Psalm 73 earlier? The way he looks at life, he says, I thought I understood God. I thought that God took care of good people and punished bad people.
I thought, surely God is good to those who are pure in heart. Surely that's how it works. I thought I understood God until I looked around the world and I saw great, big, fat, evil people. And they were happy. And they were content. They had everything that they wanted. They were comfortable. And they did everything impetuously. They walked the earth arrogantly with impunity, mocking God. Unbelievers of all kinds. And I thought, how does this gel with what I thought I knew about God? That's human life, though. That's human life. And that's how it's been since the beginning. From Cain and Abel, one good person, another an evildoer who refused to repent even in the face of God. It was true with the 12 sons of Israel. It was true when they became tribes. It was true of the kings. Good men, bad men, good women, bad women, growing up together, living life, experiencing history. We are growing together with the weeds. And that's human life. Do not be surprised or shocked by it. Because the master, the landowner, our God, already has a plan in place for dealing with it. But his servants come up to him in Matthew 13, 28 and 29. They say, "What should we gather up the tares now? Should we go weeding in the field?" And what does the master say? He says, "No. Be patient. Let's be patient. If we're too hasty here, we might go and we might hurt some of that wheat. In the process of removing the weeds, we might do damage to the wheat that surrounds them. These roots grow very tight together." You know what's interesting about that? The fact that the roots grow so tightly, so intimately together, I think it gives us an indication that we shouldn't be surprised when we find out that evil has even infested our own personal lives, our families, even our own congregation. I'm sorry to say it, it's reality that we need to stay on top of all the time. But even in our own congregation, the roots of the tares are sneaking in every day, constantly trying to break into this field of wheat. We are God's field, and the tares are trying to bring us down. There's a root coming in this way, a root coming in from above. There's a root that's sneaking into your marriage. There's a weed that's growing up in your family. Don't be shocked by it. These roots grow very tight together. It's God's call when to remove the tares. That's comforting to me because I wouldn't want to make that call, and I'm glad no angel's in charge of making that call. I'm glad no human being is in charge of making that call. You know, there are times, and I'm not saying we hop in and out of salvation constantly. That's not what I'm saying at all. But there are times I feel more like a weed than a wheat. And I'm sure glad that God doesn't pull the trigger too fast on me. I'm glad that God is patient with me and allows me to continue growing to see just what I'm going to become. Just because I act like a weed sometimes doesn't mean God doesn't see the potential within me to grow up to become a strong stalk of useful, productive wheat. It is God's call. This is a great reminder that mankind is never going to have the power to eliminate evil from the world. As much as we want to, the only one who can remove the tares is God. Not his servants, not the wheat. The only one who can remove the tares is God. He's the only one with that kind of power. I think anytime you encounter a secular humanist, and I'm not saying be a jerk about it or anything, but anytime you encounter a secular humanist, I want you to ask that person, you believe that by sheer human will we can overcome all obstacles, that humans have the potential to defeat every enemy, that we can be totally at peace, cure all diseases, that we can overcome all of the stumbling blocks that are presented to us, that it is by thought, philosophy, that it is by human will that we can fix the world's problems. End hunger. Cure AIDS. Stop wars from happening.
I'm sorry, that's just not true. And I'm not being pessimistic about it. I'm just being like the landowner. I'm just accepting the reality that it's not my power that removes the tares from the world. I can never fix totally the problem of bad people existing in this world. They will continue to grow. They will continue to spring up. So we should not despair when we discover just how much the tares have entangled themselves in the wheat. It doesn't get better with time also. You know, there's nowhere here in the parable where the landowner goes, well, you know, maybe if we're patient, the tares will just go away. My brother Kyle in Utah, he's preached here before. My little, tiny, small brother from Utah. He reseeded his front yard, his grass. But the person who reseeded specifically told him, don't mow for a certain amount of time. You've got to let that grass grow before you mow. So just water it, water it, water it. No matter how many weeds come up, you just water it. Just keep on watering. Ignore the weeds. Pretend they're not there. And then when the grass is strong enough and mature enough, then you can go in, put some weed and feed down, start dealing with the weeds. And so Kyle's house looks awful. Kyle, if you're watching this online, I'm sorry. Your lawn looks terrible. But that's what he says. Anytime someone comes to his house, he has to tell people on the way there. It's like, no, just read Matthew 13. I'm just letting the weeds grow with the wheat. But anybody who has a lawn or landscaping at all understands this. Do weeds just go away if you ignore them? If you close the blinds and say, well, you know, maybe if we just kind of leave those dandelions alone, maybe they'll go away on their own. No, they don't just go away on their own. You can't ignore the problem and they just disappear. I think the lesson then is this. Evil in this world just doesn't get better with time. Again, the secular humanist has this assumption that humanity is evolving socially, intellectually, etc. They believe that we're evolving, we're becoming more advanced, a better society, a healthier society. And that might be true in some superficial fashion. We might live a little bit longer than we did a couple centuries ago. We might have medicines that help us with certain things. But are the same spiritual problems, the same moral problems still here? Are they getting any better with time? Are people becoming less greedy? Are people becoming less covetous? Are we becoming less lustful? Are we learning to control our sex drives better than we did a couple centuries ago? Are we less prone to violence, anger, temper tantrums with each other when we're adults? Are we getting better? No, we're not getting any better. The weeds are growing just as strongly as they always have. And it is only when the harvest finally comes that God will deal with it. The time of the growing is over. The time for producing fine heads of grain for the flour to adorn the owner's table with life-giving bread has passed. The time for frustrating the good stalks of grain with constricting weeds, and their entangling roots is at an end. Nothing remains the same. The scene of the action changes. Prior to this moment, all eyes were on the field. It was the center of everything. Here was where it all happened. Now the field is left behind. Everything which was there has been taken away. We've moved beyond the field. We are now either at the fire or at the barn. So the harvest is utterly decisive. Other scriptures point this out as well. Of course, the imagery in Matthew chapter 25, in the second half of that chapter, makes it very clear. You're either a goat or you're a sheep. You're either on the right hand or you're on the left hand. You're either welcomed into God's abode or you are cast away with Satan and his angels to a place that has been prepared for them since the very beginning. In the Gospel of John, it's written the exact same way. Notice here in John's Gospel, in John chapter 5, and in verse 26, for just as the Father has life in himself, even so he gave to the Son also to have life in himself, and he gave him authority to execute judgment because he's the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming in which
all who are in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. Those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life. Those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. It is utterly, totally decisive. You're either a wheat or a weed. Today you have an opportunity to make that choice. Today you have an opportunity to either live with God in his glory or be cast away from God because you chose to reject him, not the other way around. God stands at the door and knocks. Jesus extends the hand, the invitation to come to him always. As long as there's life passing between your lips, breath coming out of your mouth, as long as you have a heartbeat in your chest, you have an opportunity to change the course of your life. Make that choice now. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.